this morning, while I was meditating before dawn, I wrote this poem entitled Until. Chant God's name, holy name, until all names resonate his glory. Visit stone temples in pilgrimage until you unlock its inner heart. Then the world, nay, this universe, becomes your sacred temple. Seek purity in the lofty giant groves until that same purity is awakened in you. Let your heart melt in holding a babe until sweet innocence is resurrected in your soul. Become merged in the ocean sunset grandeur until infinite expanse finds a gateway within. The wonders and secrets you seek in this world are but reflections of your true self. Go ahead, seek the beauty of life in its reflected images, but always remember, until you find it within, your search is incomplete, for reality cannot be permanently found in its reflected images. And this is very true, that kind of happiness that we seek in this world and through the senses is something that comes to us occasionally in the way of happiness and fulfillment, but all too often it falls short of the goal. And our design is exactly that. It's meant to disappoint in the sense that no human relationship, no sensory experience, no situation in this world can complete us, only that union with the divine. Reading from the Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. Sri Ananda Mohan Lahiri, a grandson of the Master, has written an interesting booklet on Kriya. The text of the Bhagavad Gita is a part of the great epic, the Mahabharata, which possesses several knot points, Vyasa Kutas. Sri Anand wrote, "Keep those knot points unquestioned, and we find nothing but mythical stories of a peculiar and easily misunderstood type. Keep those knot points unexplained, and we have lost a science which the East has preserved with superhuman patience after a quest of thousands of years of experiment." It was the commentaries of Lahiri Mahasaya which brought to light, clear of allegories, the very science of religion that had been so clearly put out of sight in the riddle of scriptural letters and imagery. No longer a mere unintelligible jugglery of words, the otherwise unmeaning formulas of Vedic worship have been proved by the Master to be full of scientific significance. We know that man is usually helpless against the insurgent sway of evil passions, but these are rendered powerless and man finds no motive in their indulgence when there dawns on him a consciousness of superior and lasting bliss through Kriya. Here the give up, the negation of the lower passions, synchronizes with the take up, the assertion of a beatitude. Without such a course, hundreds of moral maxims which run in the mere negatives are useless to us. Our eagerness for worldly activity kills in us the sense of spiritual awe. Our eagerness for worldly activity kills in us the sense of spiritual awe. We cannot comprehend the great life behind all names and forms just because science brings home to us how we can use the powers of nature. This familiarity has bred a contempt for her ultimate secrets. Our reflection with nature is one of practical business. We tease her, so to speak, to know how she can be used to serve our purposes. We make use of her energies, whose source yet remains unknown. In science, our relation with nature is one that exists between a man and his servant, or in a philosophical sense, she is like a captive in the witness box. We cross-examine her, challenge her, and minutely weigh her evidence in human scales which cannot measure her hidden values. On the other hand, when the self is in communion with a higher power, nature automatically obeys, without stress or strain, the will of man. This effortless command over nature is called the miraculous by the uncomprehending materialist. The life of Lahirmahasya set an example which changed the erroneous notion that yoga is a mysterious practice. Every man may find a way through Kriya to understand his proper relation with nature and to feel spiritual reverence for all phenomena, whether mystical or of everyday occurrence, in spite of the matter-of-factness of physical science. We must bear in mind that what was mystical 1,000 years ago is no longer so, and what is mysterious now may become lawfully intelligible 100 years hence. It is the infinite, the ocean of power, that is at the back of all manifestations. The law of Kriya Yoga is eternal. It is true, like mathematics. Like the simple rules of addition and subtraction, the law of Kriya can never be destroyed. Burn to ashes all books on mathematics. The logically minded will always rediscover such truths. Destroy the sacred books on yoga. Its fundamental laws will come out whenever there appears a true yogi who comprises within himself pure devotion and consequently pure knowledge. This is a wonderful writing, because in it we discover that yoga is a universal science, so to speak, in that it makes a proposition. It says that within you, dormantly hidden most occasions, but still nevertheless it is true, deep within you is your ability to consciously know the divine consciousness. And as a result of that, you might get merged into that divine consciousness to the extent that you and that divine consciousness become as one. This is a bold assertion, and it is one that runs contrary to most of our experiences. Usually we live a life that's filled with the senses. From the moment we wake up in the morning, we open these eyes, we stretch out, we begin to think about the things that we're going to do later today, and we're filled with all of the things of the senses. From morning until night, we labor to please this body and this mind. And what we don't know, we seek to find out when it's useful and necessary. But the human mind is limited, and human experience is limited, and it always leaves us feeling that there must be something more. I remember when I started this path in my late teens, and I looked around at the adults in my life and all the experiences that I had, and I didn't feel that there was anyone that I wanted to emulate. There is no course in life that I wanted to follow that I felt would lead me towards any true, lasting peace or happiness. There is no fulfillment anywhere, and as I looked out upon this world, I was filled with a kind of despair because I didn't know where to turn to. I hadn't been taught that hidden within me was this divine consciousness, yet somehow I was put onto a journey to discover that divine consciousness. I had no name for it. It was only an impulse. It was a kind of urge inside of me that couldn't be satisfied by anything else that I saw. And it wasn't until I met my guru that I learned the truth, really, that deeply hidden within me was this possibility. And that same possibility deeply exists within all of us. Now, why don't more discover and know that divine consciousness within themselves. And it's the reason is because we're not taught how to access it. And the second reason is because you need a deep and abiding desire to discover that divine consciousness. Now, when we discover that divine consciousness, what should we experience? We should know ourselves to be in intimate contact with an intelligence and a power that is supremely higher than our own human consciousness. It is an intuitive sense. It is a felt sense. You know it when you feel it. When you are simply existing in your own human consciousness, you feel self-satisfied oftentimes. You just think, well, this is how life is. This is how I am. This is who I am. And you don't think of yourself as being anything more than that. But when you have this awakening, this seed that is sown inside of you, that nothing else can fully satisfy, it puts you on this journey. And when you are lifted up into this higher intelligence and this higher power, you feel a freedom, a peace and a freedom and a joy that is simply indescribable. And that in itself begins to guide you in your life. So there comes an intuitive direction that comes from this inner power and intelligence that is blissful and joyful. These are the hallmarks of mystics and saints all around this world. If you read about the divine experiences of saints and sages from every climate, from every culture, from everywhere around this world, you will see that there are certain similarities. It is as with Raymond Moody when he began as a physician. His first conversation with a man who had died on the operating table for a short period of time, and then he was brought back to life. And the man somewhat reluctantly told him about an experience that he had when he left the body. And his consciousness was suddenly awake, and he was aware, even though his eyes were closed, he was able to see down from the ceiling, it appeared, and he saw his own dead body, and was being worked on by the physicians in attendance. Then his attention was drawn toward this tunnel of light, and as he followed this light, he emerged into this world, where then he reviewed his lifetime. And there was a being of light that was tremendous that sat next to him as he reviewed his lifetime. And intuitively, through thought transference, this being of light gave approval or disapproval to different actions and activities as he reviewed his life, and he knew where he had done something well, or he had blown it, and he hadn't done it well at all. Now, this being of light is his own soul. It is his own divine intelligence. And because he has not learned yet how to become one with it, he sees it as something separate from himself. Well, as he had this experience, and he was lifted into that divine consciousness, with that intelligence informing him of the right and wrong actions that he had taken, he was then gradually brought back down into a earthly consciousness. And suddenly he was back in the body, and the doctors had resuscitated him. And all of this had happened in the short span of a few minutes while he was technically dead. Dr. Moody began to talk to many other people and ask about this, and here and there were some who reluctantly, usually, because they thought perhaps it was hallucination. They had never heard of such a thing before from anybody else, so they were reluctant to say anything. Not only that, it was a sacred experience to them and life-changing. And there were two themes that Dr. Moody said that most people brought back with them from these near-death experiences, and that is that life is to be one of learning. And the other is, how much do we love? So how much do we learn and how much do we love? And if it doesn't entail one of those two things, then it probably doesn't have that much lasting value to it. So many people coming back return to school, even though they may have been older or they healed relationships in their lives that had been broken, because they realize that these are the things that are truly important at the end of your life. All of the other things that consume our time and our days suddenly pale into insignificance. Now we have to earn a living, and we have to care for our home, usually, and vehicles and other material items that we have. But really, all of these things are the maintenance of life, and they don't leave that lasting impression. When you live a life, not only the length of your life, but the width of your life. In other words, just living the length of your life is just putting in your time. And it's not really living life fully. I remember that I was born into this world, and one of the samskaras, or the habit patterns that I was born into this life with, was a kind of hesitancy about entering fully into life. And it was built on a fear of failure. And that if I didn't do it right, there was a lot of shame associated with it, and so sometimes better not to try it at all, or just do it in a half-hearted manner. And, if it didn't work out, well, I didn't try my best, so my whole ego wasn't invested in it then. And so, at some point, I came to realize, I didn't always think of it in that way, but I came to realize that I wasn't living life in the full width of it. I was putting in my time. But I was always hedging my bets. I was never fully in it with both feet. And I realized that if I was ever going to live life fully, I had to put both feet in. I had to be fully committed. And in order to do that, I had to face my fear. My fear of what would happen if I put myself fully in, and perhaps what would it be if I failed, if I didn't make it. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna assures us that whatever progress we make in a particular lifetime, we take that progress with us. There are no failed attempts in that sense. That we keep trying. We keep building ourselves. We keep getting stronger. And with every failed attempt, we learn something. And we take that knowledge and we apply it. And when we apply it with all of our strength, all of our heart, all of our good intentions, then something will give and it changes. And we break through a barrier that before had been a ceiling to us, and now we burst through it, and we enter into a whole new world. We are intended to live life fully, not only the length of our lives, but the width of our lives as well, the depth, the height, everything. And when we do this, we fulfill what we came for. It's a wonderful meditation. To think about breathing your last breath. Now, some may think, oh, that's a macabre thing, or I don't want to precede myself with the thought of death. Maybe I'll bring that on. But it's a good thing to meditate on, because when you think about your last breath, you think about doing it without any fear whatsoever. You breathe out that last breath. And when you breathe out that last breath, your spirit goes out from your body. And it expands out and out and out. Not into a cold kind of death, but into the warmth and light of divine consciousness. You're really freeing yourself from a very heavy, leaden overcoat of this body. And you're freeing yourself into a wonderful realm of light. You are no longer burdened by the things of this world and by this body. It's a freeing event when it happens. It's nothing to be afraid of. And when we release ourselves and we free ourselves, then we look back over this life. And even as a meditation practice, as you think of projecting yourself to that moment and that day, when you free yourself from this body and then you look back on this life, how did I do? How did I do? I remember a time when I had lived a life. And I remember that time of freeing myself from the body. And then I was reviewing my life. And I had gotten caught up in all the details of life, and I hadn't made any real spiritual progress. And I felt that I had let myself down so much. You know, people are afraid of being judged by God or by somebody else, but really, the judge is inside of us. We know what is right and what is wrong. We know what uplifts and we know what degrades. And so it is the internal witness that cannot be fooled, that one who knows right from wrong, high from low. And as I reviewed my life, I knew that I had not really fulfilled the purpose that I had come to. And I made a deep resolution inside of myself that I never wanted to waste another lifetime again. I wanted to remember during the life the real purpose for which I have come. Now, the real purpose is in God realization, self-realization with a capital S. That divine revelation that shows you down to the core of your being who and what you are. Until there is no doubt left in any corner of your mind. It is a light that shines so perfectly and so purely within you that it radiates through every part of your being. There is no darkened corner left. And when your entire being shines with that divine light and radiance and knowledge, then you are free. And you have fulfilled what you have come to do. Now you serve. You serve that divine light as it instructs you, as it prompts you to do. But that is, as Mother Hamilton said, the pearl of great price. The story goes of a man who had a tremendously valuable pearl. It was the most valuable pearl in the world. And he had an asking price. And it was $1,000 at the time, which is a great deal of money at that time. And nobody is willing to pay it. And finally, one man decided to bargain for it. And he says, well, I'll give you $500 for it. The man said, no. The price is $1,000. He said, I'll give you $750. He was not dissuaded. And the man said, no. It's a full $1,000. Finally, the man tested him. He says, I'll give you $995.50. No. Only the full price. Only the full price. And what is the full price to gain our realization? It is to surrender ourselves totally and completely to the divine consciousness. To allow ourselves to be emptied out every aspect of ourselves. Taken down to the very core. That all the ego consciousness is completely destroyed. This is the mystical crucifixion that is described in the New Testament Christian scriptures. And it is this crucifixion. It is a battlefield in the East, in the Mahabharata. It is the battlefield as it is described there. It's both describing the same experience. This tremendously powerful kundalini force, it's a divine force that's at the base of your spine, suddenly bursts up through your spine. And it begins to clear a pathway from the base of your spine all the way to the top of your head. The first time I had this experience, I was living in Bellingham, Washington, and going to the university there. I was sitting with a meditation group. And suddenly, my attention became very intensely focused at the center of my forehead, at the ajna, the third eye point there. And as it did so, there was as if a snap at the base of my spine, and this heat and power rushed up my spine to the back of my skull area and then across through the brain. I could mark it exactly how this power erupted and went through me and absolutely riveted my attention on the ajna, or the third eye point. And I couldn't take my attention away from that even as I tried. It was painful, and it was a tremendous heat that was there. And it felt like it was going to get so hot that I could fry eggs with like a frying pan. And as this heat was there, it was an original moment of this tremendous force that had erupted inside of me. And this was the Kundalini, and it was there with a purpose. It's there to take us through the evolutionary course that we must go through in order to go from human consciousness only to divine consciousness. And it has this evolutionary purpose. It takes us to the next step in evolution from the human to the divine. And as the reading said here from Lhari Maharshi's grandson, or son rather, is that it's like mathematics. It's true. It's true whether you're born in the West or born in the East, whether you are born a yogi or whether you are driven to be a mystic in some other culture, it doesn't make any difference. The pathway is the same. And it is the razor's edge, as it says in the Vedas, the razor's edge, because you must follow only the highest path of purity if you are to complete this evolutionary course. There are many temptations that come to you. There are many psychic powers that come to you. There are many desires that come as a matter of course, because as you awaken these energies, they are purifying to you. But through this purification process, there are many things that come up from your past, and they come as temptations, and you have to face them, and you have to overcome them. And if you don't, it retards your progress. And if you go so much against the divine consciousness, you can really hurt yourself if you betray the pure and noble purpose for which this energy has come into your being. But if you stay true to your purpose and you don't look to the left and you don't look to the right, you go only on that razor's edge, then there is a purification that happens, and as your mind becomes purified, it becomes filled with light. And that light is a radiance of the divine consciousness within you. Now, nobody on the outside necessarily can see this, not through human eyes. But that light is radiating inside of you, and it begins to change the course of your life. And your life will never be the same. And in a totally positive and good way. But it is a tremendously difficult path. There should be no mistake about that. There are some people who like to make promises of an easy journey towards divine realization. Now, there are definitely methods and techniques that can make it much easier, much more efficient. But if we are willing to pay this price, the total price of total surrender and total dedication and total loyalty, then what we will gain is something that no one can ever take from you. It is the complete and total realization of you, who you really are. And when you have that, you become a freed soul, a jiva mukta, a freed soul while here on earth. But even then, you may have some karma to work out. That law of cause and effect, that reaches back through millennia. And as you work that out gradually, gradually, you come to the point where there is no more karma, there is no more restriction. You are now an instrument of pure divine consciousness. And there is nothing but divine consciousness all around you. You realize that this entire universe is made up of ananda, of bliss, of joy. Now, when we look through this human mind and these human eyes, we don't see it that way. We see what's wrong with this world. Sometimes we see its beauty, but we also see its ugliness. We see its golden moments and we see its dark moments. But when you look through divine eyes, through divine vision, the universal vision, then you know without a doubt that this entire universe is made up of this blissful energy. Kabir says that it makes me laugh to hear that a fish that is in the ocean says that it is thirsty. And we are the fish. We live in ignorance of who and what we really are. We become consumed with the minutiae of life. Who said what to who? Who's getting advanced and who's going back? What one person says and what another person thinks, and it's all about the horizontal plane of this world. And we completely miss the vertical ascent that takes us into spiritual consciousness. Now we have free will and we can do this. And we can still be a good person, so to speak, and try to do the right things, but we deny ourselves the greatest experience possible. And that is to come into oneness with divine consciousness. And then a bliss begins to well up inside of you. It bubbles up naturally. Purity, the kind of purity that when you hold a babe in your arms and you feel that natural love and innocence and purity pouring out of you, that's now with you always. You are a wonderful creation. A wonderful creation. Filled with divine potential and light. Why waste a life in the mundane and ordinary activities? We need to live a life of balance, so it's all right. We earn a living. We do the things that bring about simple pleasures, but we don't do that to the extent that we do not seek the higher divine consciousness. I beg of you, do not deny yourself that great privilege. Do not be afraid, but step forward boldly. Proclaim your divine heritage and find it as a natural force and intelligence dwelling deep within your own being, and that you can have bliss and light and life in greater measure than you could ever imagine as it constantly erupts inside of you and sings you as a sweet lullaby, and then comes as a tremendous storm of force, and then subsides into a deep quiet. And it's a constant ebb and flow. We were sitting this morning in the redwoods, in a cathedral-type setting, these giants all around us, and inwardly, without human ears, listening to the sound of nature, the sound of forests, singing a mighty song of Om, and feeling the vibration of these great beings inhabiting these trees that rose up for 100 feet or more. You see, this entire creation is filled with life. There are great beings who live within mountains. Sometimes there is a soul that just wants to take a rest, just wants to have that experience. One of my first experiences coming into this creation was as a lava flow. And I felt myself as molten rock moving, just like a river, only slower. But it had that liquid-like motion to it. And it was wonderful, and then it began to cool and it solidified, and it was no longer had any kind of mobility. But consciousness was still merged into that part of nature. Awareness was there. And so it is everywhere that we look about us. We live in a magnificent creation. And what our eyes see and what our ears hear, what our touch touches, is just but a small portion of what is revealed. Just as there are X-rays and gamma rays and all sorts of levels of creation that we're unaware of unless we have certain instruments to be able to see it and detect it. There is spiritual consciousness, and when your antenna is tuned only to the station of the senses, you simply are not receiving the divine signals. But tune your inner radio to the divine consciousness, and suddenly a whole new station opens up for you. New experience opens up for you. And it's not a thing of imagination. It's not a thing that your mind is just making up. Because the experience is so profound, so true, so real, it makes ordinary sensory experience seem like a dream, unreal. It is more true. It is more real. It is supersensory. And as a result of that, you begin to awaken to who you really are. So again, let us not waste a life. Arise, awake, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita. Do not allow yourself to sleepwalk through life. The Buddha means the awakened one. Awaken. Set the alarm clock. Dedicate yourself towards the proposition that you are made in God's likeness and image. Likeness is spirit and image is form. You have it all within you. And if you do not have the intensity of desire, you can pray for that and open yourself to it. And it will come to you. It will come. Now, are there any questions or observations about anything that I've spoken about this evening or your own spiritual journey? Good. Everybody's floating on the ocean of bliss. No questions.
You know, I'm always confused about this one thing. And that is if we know what's good for us, and we've had God experience, why aren't we just pursuing that all the time, 100% of the time? You know, why do we go back and do our...
It is one of the great mysteries, isn't it, that we can have moments of enlightenment and we know it all. And it seems to us in that moment of upliftment and enlightenment, we've always known it. It's always been true. This is who we don't become somebody new or different. We really become ourselves. And we think, there's no other way that I ever want to be. And then it seems as if we're raised up on that balloon of experience and consciousness, and then heavy lead weights are added, and we come down and down, and we can feel ourselves coming down. And suddenly we land on the earth with a thud, and we're back. And then within a short amount of time, it's as if we never had that experience. We can barely remember what it's like. We get caught up in the things of the world and the things of the senses, and we can even get to where we completely forget that that ever happened. In yoga, the generalized term for that field of separation from the divine to the particular individual is maya, when it's spread all around. When it's us individually, it's called avidya. And it's one of the great mysteries in life. If we are divine beings and we have this divine consciousness, why do we live in this field of separation? I was talking about this first incarnation that I had as lava flowing, this liquid rock. And I remember being that freed spirit, and I was looking at this liquid rock and thinking, what a marvelous thing that was, and what would that be like to have that experience of merging myself in with that liquid rock and feeling myself moving with it. And as I thought about wanting and desiring to have that experience, I started to have that experience. And then that's what that feels like. And I had that movement, and it drew me into it. Now, what we know is that as individual souls, we have an indissoluble link with the divine. We can never not have that. We can never not be a divine soul. That is something that is sacrosanct. But in our consciousness, we can have a field of separation that makes us feel as if we're completely separate from that. And as we enter into this material creation, and our fascination grows with it, we have that field of separation begins to grow thicker and thicker. Now, in the Old Testament, in the creation story, it talks about Adam and Eve, and Adam and Eve are the original innocence. It is the male and female principle that is within each human being. And they're told not to eat of the fruit that's in the midst of the garden. And that in particular is the sexual activity, because if we do, it draws our attention down, and it represents the polar opposite of the spiritual energy risen up. And it can be represented by any number of kinds of human experiences that we have, but sexuality is one of the most powerful that welds us into this body. And when that happens and we sacrifice, so to speak, the divine consciousness for the sake of having an experience in the senses, then we have that field of separation. Now, I was describing how we're lifted up in that balloon of consciousness, and then it seems as if lead weights are added to that and we're drawn down. And I remember having that experience so many times, and I just felt helpless in it. I just know I didn't want that to happen. But as I really analyzed it, I would see that certain thoughts were flowing through my mind at that time, and I would attach significance to certain thoughts. They might be positive or they might be negative. Didn't make any difference. I attached myself to them. And when I did that, that was the lead weights that started to draw me back down to normal consciousness, earthly consciousness. Unfortunately, at the time, it was more normal consciousness than not. So our mind is the culprit, and the attachments that it takes on, it identifies with things. And the purification of the mind is purifying ourselves of those attachments. Now, we are told to live in the world, but not be of the world. We live in this body. I have a mind. I have these senses. I have these emotions. But I am not those emotions. I am not defined by them. I am not attached to them. They come and they go. They come and they go. And when I can really live in that consciousness where they come and they go, and I don't give any more attachment to them than that, I don't identify with them, then we are freed. But that is the pearl of great price. So how do we learn? We go up. We have an experience there. It's maddening, but we're drawn back down. It's not what we want, and yet it's what a part of our own mind is creating.
So many times, the thought that draws me down is the fear of being drawn down.
It's exactly right.
Oh, no, I'm losing it. You know?
This is so wonderful. I don't want it to end. Oh, that's just one of those weights. The thought of separation has, and we have attached ourselves to it.
Right.
Attached significance, attached power.
The fear of separation.
That's right. So it's either positive or negative. It makes no difference.
I think that's why it's called practice. You have to keep practicing.
More practice and more purification. When the mind becomes completely purified, then it doesn't attach itself to any particular thought or feeling. It's freed. It's those thoughts and those feelings. We have all kinds of thoughts and feelings that flow through us. We have all kinds of sensory experience. My eyes see much more than what my mind registers. I see everything in this room, but my mind only registers so much of it because it's efficient for me to do it that way. I try to pick out the things that are important to it. So our thoughts are constantly flowing to us. Why does some take on an importance and others just pass right on by? It's our attachment to them. So when you're able to live in this world but not be of this world, you've purified the mind, and then you can retain that divine consciousness at all times. There's no limit.
Can hardly wait.
Hardly wait. So we strive, we practice. And sometimes the more maddening, the more disheartening it is, that's a good sign. Because it means we've purified ourselves. That's what I want. I know that that's what I want. And we seem to be at war with ourselves. A part of ourselves wants it, and a part of ourselves seems repelled by it. This is human nature. It's what we all go through. It's just, do we keep ourselves on the field? Or do we get discouraged? Or do we get lost? Or do we get taken away on some sidetrack that lasts for a few lifetimes, and then eventually we wake up again and, okay, I'm going to get it right this time. But as Elizabeth Hike said, eternity is long enough. It's usually most of us don't want to wait in eternity. We want it now, and rightfully so. Rightfully so.
Tuning in to that stream, and it seems on one hand you want to, like, if you don't feel like you're tuned in, race through the dial. Mm-hmm. All you do is race through the dial and miss it. Or it's just ratcheting a little bit at a time. Seems like it'll, you might be at the wrong end of the whole spectrum, and I don't know if there's any.
I think that anytime we let the mind go inward and just say, where's that divine contact at? Oftentimes down in the heart center, there can be some sense of peace, some sense of connection there. And it may be even a bit of a painful situation because we've been missing that for so long. And so when we get connected, there's kind of a sweet pain in there. But there is some place of connection. And if the mind oftentimes judges it and says, well, that's not enough, or that's not big, or that's not what I was expecting or what I was wanting. But if we don't judge it, if we just stay focused, we're tuning the dial of the radio, and we just say, all right, that's the place of connection. Let me hold the mind there. Just hold the mind there. The signal will get stronger then. We breathe with it, and we work with it, and We don't try to chase after it. Master wrote a poem where he was meditating and he saw the taper of light burning there in the ajna. And like a madman, he went running after it. And the more he ran after it, the more the light receded. Oh, it was so maddening to him. So then he sat down and started meditating again. He saw the light there again. He raced after it again, wanting to grab it, wanting to get it. Again, it receded. Finally, he started learning the lesson. Oh, he saw the light there. He didn't run after it. He just kept his concentration on it. The light started to burn brighter and brighter and brighter. And that one of the things that we don't know is that God is constantly coming to us. We feel like we're chasing after God. And Master loved the poem about the hound of heaven. And the hound of heaven was chasing the man. And the man was running away. And it was the hound of heaven, though. It was the divine consciousness that was in pursuit of the human. And Ananda Moyama said a wonderful thing one time. She said, "You could not think of me if I did not think of you first." That's God talking to us. So we think we're chasing after God and God's being elusive, when in reality, what's awakened ourselves to the search in the first place is the divine principle working inside of us. And it's waking us up, and that's why we have even an interest in it in the first place. So that's a wonderfully encouraging kind of thought. And if we just allow it to come and capture us, rather than run away from it, or search out there someplace, and open ourselves to it, then we can really allow it to begin to embrace us. And it does. It does. God is not some impersonal force that has no interest in our individuality. It has an intense. It is the divine consciousness that has become this human being. And is intensely interested, each individually, in our lives. Now, that may seem mind-blowing that there's, 6-7 billion people on this earth. And yet, divine consciousness can be interested in each and every individual. And this is just one small little mud ball of a planet spinning through space. There's a vast creation. And divine consciousness is equally aware of every aspect. No atom that's too small to escape notice. It's a mind-blowing concept, but it's true. So never think that you're in it alone, that divine consciousness, grace, has already entered into you. It's working like yeast, helping to raise the bread. But the bread doesn't just pop open all of a sudden. It's gradual, huh? It heats up and it starts to unfold and it starts to grow, and then one day all of a sudden it's there. But if you take the bud of the flower and you start to try to peel those petals back, that doesn't work so good. It doesn't help it to peel. It doesn't help it to unfold. Just patiently, patiently creating the conditions for it to open. Divine grace is operating in you now, even now. And it's far more powerful than you can imagine. But it comes as a seed and then grows into this magnificent tree. Does that make sense?
Thank you. I've got a little quote from Master.
Aha.
Uh-huh.
Yes, of course.
Self-realization is the knowing in body, mind, and soul that we are one with the omnipresence of God. That we do not have to pray that it come to us. That we are not merely near it at all times. But that God's omnipresence is our omnipresence.
Yeah.
That we are just as much a part of Him now as we will ever be. All we have to do is improve our knowing.
Yes. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one I keep in here.
I can tell it's on the special place in there. And that's absolutely true. We are already realized beings. But if you think about a child who's growing up and it's in, say, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, you're seeing it unfold as it goes through all the different stages. You know, embedded within that future for that child is a university student and then an adult, and you know, it's all marching towards that. And of course, the child oftentimes it's told it's too young, or it's told it's too old, or too something, you know, so it doesn't get to do what it would like to do, and it gets frustrated. But if it could just know that life is inevitably taking it towards its destination, and for it just to tune in with the divine intelligence, tune into it and let it unfold inside. There's a story in India of a man riding on a train, and he gets onto the train, and he's got a big, heavy piece of luggage. He's carrying it on his head. Ticket conductor comes along, says, "Do you have your ticket?" He hands him his ticket. Conductor says, "You know, the train's going to take you to the next destination, whether you're baggage is on top of your head or whether you set it down on the floor. Why don't you set it down on the floor and enjoy the trip?" So life is taking us. It's inevitable. And if we cooperate by staying on the train and keep tuning in to those divine vibrations, it will inevitably take us to our goal. It's a wonderful thought to hold on to and to know. And it's a reality.
Yeah, I've gotten into the out of the fear and the self-doubt and the confusion. Like, things are just as they are.
Yeah.
And it's like where you're saying, tuning into stuff.
Right.
It's just, you know, that's how I got out of the book, Autobiography of Yogi. It's just, you just tune into
right.
What it is, and you tap into that consciousness. And
there's a frequency of vibration that will lift us all the way up to the top. And the key is keeping the mind dialed in, tuned in to that frequency, the highest frequency that we know at any particular time, and keep the mind there. And we'll feel it when we're being drawn off onto something else. And it's, no, I know where that takes me to. I'm not going to go there. And bring the mind back. Bring the mind back.
How do you feel about, do you have any kind of practice that specifically on focusing on love?
Well, on opening of the heart center, of course. Yeah. And that is one of the highest frequencies that we can tune into. And when you feel that, it's not a human love in the sense that human love is rooted in loving another person and loving a situation, and but this is divine love itself. It's self-contained and self-existent. It doesn't need a subject and an object. And yet it seems to have a movement and a flow. And as your heart opens to that and you feel that movement, that flow of divine love through you, and then let it go out through your activities in service to other people and to creation, not with any end in sight, just simply as an expression of the love that is within you. And as you do that, and you feel the ocean of love that you exist in, then that's all that there is. And that is a purifying force that will take you all the way to the divine. For my own guru, it was that love that took her all the way into the divine consciousness.
That's all I focus on.
Yeah.
That's all, it seems to be everything I need.
Yes. Not to confuse it with the love of the senses or the love of human beings or that highest frequency of love.
Unconditional.
That's right. And without that is self-existent.
It's like a river.
Yes, that's right. And so it does not need an object in that. It's just simply the flow of love and tuning into that. Mm-hmm. Lovely to have satsang. gathering together for truth. Okay, let us just for a moment tune in to that love. And the heart center is located differently than the physical heart. The physical heart, as we know, is a little over to the left, lower left part of the chest. But in the astral body is the heart center that's right at the center. If you see the pictures of Jesus with the heart and the crown of thorns, and it's right in the center, it's reflective of that heart center that's right there. And to whatever extent it occurs for you, just tune the mind in to the heart center there and breathe. Feel the breath moving all the way down to your stomach. That is, when you breathe in, the stomach slightly rises. When you breathe out, the stomach slightly contracts. And then there at the center of your chest, just sense, just feel, just imagine that the heart is opening up, and from behind you is a river-like force of light and love and divine consciousness. It feels peaceful, and it is flowing. It is always flowing. Now sometimes, particularly if your heart has not been open, you may feel that as a blockage. You may feel it painful. Just breathe with that, breathing to your stomach. And to whatever degree it opens and you feel and sense that movement and that flow, let it move through you and flow from behind you and through you and out to the world from you. And suddenly you may feel a little smile on your face. You may sense a movement, and do not judge it, that it's not enough, or it's not the right kind, or anything of the sort. Just keep being attentive to the sense of movement through you. It may be slow, it may be fast, it may be small, it may be as wide can be. And feel that love deep in your own heart. You may feel like you are a desert ground that's been thirsty for so very long. And that love can come in and just saturate you, imbue you with that divine love. And then perhaps you'll feel it flowing out from you and to everybody who's in this room. And filling up the room and feeling this room is filled with that divine love. And then it expands out. And in your mind's eye, you can see this entire world, a recipient of that ocean and river of love. A tiny bubble floating in space, this earth is, in a sea of divine love and light. And go on expanding that until you see this entire universe as if in an ocean of love. And then to see this universe itself as a tiny island in a vast ocean of light and love. And on and on and on it goes. There is no limit to the expansiveness and the size and the depth and the breadth of that love. And as you feel your heart going out in infinite reach, and you know that you are that, and that is you, and whether you're experiencing that love in your own individuality of human expression, or feeling it in the vastness of infinite reach, it is the same love. It can be the size of an atom or greater than the universe. It's the same quality. Mother Teresa of Calcutta said, "There are no great acts of love, there are only small acts of love." She's speaking to this universal nature of love. And it is part and parcel of your being. It is an eternal gift that cannot be taken away. You may lose hold of it at times, but it is eternally yours. And all you need do is open yourself to the flow of that divine consciousness, that divine love. You see, even as these words speak themselves through me, do not feel that I have a body. But it is a limitless expanse, the ocean of love and peace and light. So I tell you from my own experience, what is possible? I pranam to you, the light that is within you, that it ever awaken itself within you, guide you, and make you know who and what you truly are.